MGM Springfield is going to be your go-to destination for all your post-game celebrations. As a proud partner of the University of Connecticut, we invite fans to keep the fun going by checking out all the entertainment MGM Resorts has to offer by visiting mgmspringfield.com.
In sports, there are smart moves and not so smart moves. Like making sure you get to practice on time. That's smart. Parking in the coach's spot? Not so smart. And the same is true when you're hiring. There are smart ways and not so smart ways to get things done. Like job sites that overwhelm you with tons of the wrong resumes. That's not smart. But posting a job on ZipRecruiter and letting them find the right candidates for you? Now that's smart. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply. So you get qualified candidates fast, which is why it's rated number one by employers in the U.S. based on Trustpilot rating of hiring sites with at least 1,000 reviews. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Gino. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/GENO. So if you're looking for a smart way to find the right talent for your team, go to ZipRecruiter.com/Gino today. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire and the official job site of college sports fans everywhere. This is Gino Auriemma, and this is Holding Court. Year two. You're more famous in China than LiAngelo Ball. I mean, and he just became famous. You're way more famous than him.
When we were on runs, undefeated runs, who was I calling?
If he's
Gino,
calling
what do
me,
I do?
There's
we're 21-0. How do I keep this going?
Make sure you tell your mom hello.
I got to tell you, you know, she still watches you on TV. Remember, she even said this. She said, Charles, I like you. I like you a lot. And you were smiling. You know, but then she said, but I love the Shaq.
I'm going to forgive her for that.
Welcome, everyone, to the next installment of Holding Court with Gino Auriemma. This is Gino Auriemma. Hopefully, you've gotten the sense now of our previous podcast. We touch on a lot of things, mostly sports, but not always. Some, you know, popular. Some maybe not so well-known, but always interesting, I hope. And today's guest has a famous last name and has become famous in his own right, Jeremy Schapp, son of the legendary Dick Schapp, who people my age grew up with, very influential sports reporter, writer, author. And Jeremy now, very prominent writer, journalist, sportscaster at ESPN, among other various projects that he does. And we're going to touch on a lot of different topics, hopefully ones that you'll find interesting and ones that you'll find thought-provoking. Here we go. I didn't grow up with a famous dad. My son did. My son grew up with a famous dad. And I remember, and he actually played basketball, and he was actually really, really good. And I know some of the things that, you know, growing up and through high school and all that. Tell me about growing up with your dad and watching him on TV and reading his stuff and listening to people talk about him. At what point did you think, you know, I want to be like that, or I want to do something like that, not necessarily be like my dad?
You know, I wouldn't say it was from the very beginning. I mean, growing up with my dad, you know, it was a lot of fun. I mean, in the 1970s in New York, you know, he wasn't just the guy who covered sports, wasn't just the guy on TV talking about sports. He was kind of part of the scene. You know, he knew these guys. He had relationships with these guys. So, you know, they were friends of his. They were business partners as well. He wrote books with, you know, Dave DeBuscher and Tom Seaver, Joe Namath, Frank Gehry, my godfather, Jerry Kramer. And he wrote, and he was very close with, you know, Ali, all of those Knicks from that era. You know, Reggie Jackson came over the house. So if there was somebody who mattered in the world of sports, pretty much, my dad knew them. So it felt natural to be around that. And And it was fun. I mean, most of my weekends, you know, these days, I think things have changed. You know, parents take their kids to, you know, their little league games and all that kind of stuff. I just tagged along with my dad to work. I mean, my weekends were pretty much up at NBC where he was working when I was a little kid, hanging out and just watching him do his shows, do pieces, do the live sports stuff. And it seemed like a lot of fun. I mean, I got to see all these great games. I was present at some of the most historic moments in sport. You know, he took me to spring training. That was like being in a candy store for me.
Right.
He loved baseball. So it was great. Why wouldn't you want to do that, be a part of that? Because it really never felt, I think, to him like work.
And that's everybody's dream, you know, to actually have a job where it's not work. I mean, you know. I had a job where a bunch of jobs where I actually had to go to work and actually do work. So
right.
When people say, you know, is it hard work coaching basketball? I say, well, I don't have any calluses on my hands, so I don't think it is.
Right.
But I have calluses in my brain, I guess. That's where we get them. But growing up, what was your favorite sport?
I was a baseball guy. I
yeah,
really
me
was.
Too.
I mean, I had an appreciation for all of them. I think, you know, I was growing up in the Ali, Frazier, Foreman era, and so boxing was also, it was just such a big part of everything we talked about in sports at that point when I was a little kid, so I was enthusiastic about the history of it. But for me, I've always been attracted to as much as what's going on now, and sometimes more so, the history. So my dad took me to Game 6 of the 77 World Series, and I saw Reggie Jackson hit 3 home runs that night.
Oh, wow.
In the World Series. Off.
How about that?
Sosa, Hooten, and Huff were the 3 pitchers. And up until that point, I was 8. I was kind of probably maybe even a below average sports fan. You know, I was 8. I was into dinosaurs like a lot of kids and Star Trek and stuff. But then something clicked that night. I don't know. There was something about seeing Reggie and that excitement, you know, and the craziness in the Bronx, in the South Bronx in 1977. Oh, wow. Yeah, yesterday was the anniversary, I guess.
How about that?
It was like a light bulb going on. And I think I stayed up all night reading baseball books. And from that point on, I became, in my father's words, insufferable. all I wanted to do was talk about baseball. I mean, you know, he wrote a story about it, actually, for the New York Times, about my obsession with baseball. And I mean, you know, we'd sit down for dinner at night. I'd say, Dad, who do you think was a greater manager, Connie Mack or John McGraw? You know, and he'd say, shut up, just enough, you know, but I was obsessed with it.
You know, it's funny, during the mid-60s, when I came over from Italy in 61, when I turned 10, which would be 1964,
mm-hmm.
Same thing, you know, I was just fascinated by the game of baseball because, you know, when you grow up in, you know, when you're in Italy, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, you don't, you know, other than soccer and stuff, you know. So the game, and I can relate to what you're saying. You wanted to know everything about the game. You wanted to know, you know, about Tris Speaker and Ty Cobb
yeah.
and, you know, Christy Mathewson. And you wanted to, you know, you watch the old, the Babe Ruth story, you know, and you know, what was it, William Bendix playing Babe Ruth?
Not a great Babe Ruth.
Not a great Babe Ruth. And he must have given people like the impression that Babe Ruth was not a good athlete, and he was an amazing athlete, right? So when you're a kid and you have the ability to discuss this at home, what was it like with your friends? Like as you started to become, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, you get to that middle school era. And did you find friends that shared the same passion for baseball or other
did.
Sports?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, just very typical boy, obsessed with sports, in particular baseball, wanted to be playing all the time, wanted to talk about baseball all the time, wanted to go to every game. And I found, you know, and you know, on an emotional level, too, my parents went through a public, nasty divorce in the late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think without even obviously realizing at the time baseball was kind of this emotional crutch for me. And I could, whatever was going on in my life and dealing with all that stuff, I always had baseball and to come back to. And the game, you know, it just meant so much to me. I became kind of a history buff in general. I was probably the only, you know, the only 10-year-old kid in New York who was familiar with, like, the, you know, order of battle for the Allied armies, you know, in World War II. I just, and part of it was I spent a lot of time with older people. I spent a lot of time with my dad. I spent a lot of time, particularly after my parents got divorced, with my grandfather, my mother's father, who was a history buff and a big baseball guy and a Brooklyn guy. So, you know, I felt like, even though it was the 1970s and 80s, I felt like Dazzy Vance, who hadn't pitched since about 1931, was part of my life. Zach Wheat, who hadn't hit since about 1924, was a part of my life. And although he was a Dodgers guy, the Wheat and Vance were like kind of one and two. You know, he loved Christy Mathewson. So there was kind of this emotional connection. Other kids, every once in a while, I'd have a friend who had similar enthusiasms. You know, I hadn't met Keith Olbermann yet, so he certainly outdoes me in all this stuff. But there was something about the game and the history and the way it connects generations. None of this, obviously, you know, could I articulate or even process. But now I kind of understand it to be a way of connecting with my father and grandfather.
When you got to high school, as you're growing up and you get to high school, and then, you know, heading off to college, at what point did it become serious that, yeah, I'm going to have a career in journalism?
Well, for me, I'd say it was, you know, pretty early in high school. I started working for the school paper, and my after-school job was with a publishing company at one point. And, you know, I can't say that I knew at that point that I wanted to be a sports writer, or I wanted to be a sports broadcaster, or I wanted to do news, or I wanted, you know, whatever it was. But I knew that that was the business that interested me. So by the time I get to college, I went off to college in 1987 as a freshman. You know, the first thing I did was go to the office of the school paper, sign up, start working for the school paper. And the first sport I covered actually was women's basketball. I was assigned to cover the Cornell women's basketball team in 1987-1988. And actually, the UConn program has a connection to the Cornell women's program, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, Chris Daly.
That's right. And she had already left, but she had worked with the woman who at the time was the coach of the women's basketball program.
Yep.
At Cornell.
Yep.
And, you know, and then you cover all the different sports. But that was my goal. I went off to college not to be any kind of great scholar or to really take advantage of the incredible educational opportunities at one of the world's great research universities, but to work for the daily newspaper. And that was where that was the best education you could get. There was no journalism program, nothing like that. My school at Cornell, it was all working on the job, you know, with a bunch of kids, student journalists, and you know, you learn a lot of lessons that way. And you've been working with dealing with student journalists for a long time, and I'm sure a lot of them are really good, and a lot of them, you know, aren't. Well, I was certainly in the latter category.
when the old Big East was in its heyday, the worst place to go and the best place to go for us to play, it was the worst and the best,
right,
was Syracuse University. Because you get there, and you know what I'm going to say. You get there, and you got 45 wannabe Bob Costas, Bermans, or whoever the hell they want to be. And they all got, you know, they all think they're working for Outside the Lines, or they're doing 60 Minutes,
right.
And they all have these incredible questions about this and that, and I'm thinking, oh my God, these guys are going to grow up to be those guys. And there's 40 of them, and they all want to interview you. They all want to do their own deal.
Yeah.
And it was really cool to say, you know, like these kids, they act the part. They act like, hey, I'm going to be famous someday, and I'm going to do this.
Many of those Syracuse kids, not only, you know, some of them are famous, and other ones are just the bosses here, so I got to be careful what I say.
Yeah. But there's another connection that I have with Cornell Athletics, and one of my best friends played lacrosse and then coached at Cornell, Bruce Arena.
Oh, Bruce is one of your best friends?
Yeah.
I mean, Bruce, obviously, Bruce is a Cornell legend and a legend Cornell beyond legend. Cornell.
And he's a legend in his own mind as well. Yeah, yeah.
Dave, of course, was, you know, his number two guy on the U.S. national team, and he used to be the Cornell head coach. And
Yeah.
You know, I
all those guys.
I barely know Bruce. Somehow all the years at Cornell, we never really crossed paths very much. I think the first time I met him, actually, other than attending games in which he played when I was a kid, I think the first locker room I was ever in was a Cornell lacrosse locker room in 76 in Rutgers. Richie Moran, my dad, played lacrosse at Cornell. And great Richie Moran had one of his national title teams that year. And I remember we went there, and I think my dad spoke to the team. So, well, Bruce would have left. Might have been coaching at that point. Anyway, the point is, great guy. Great guy. So I'm walking the grounds at the Masters a couple of years ago, right when he was coming back to the U.S. National team. He was incognito.
Well, you know, he's a New York guy. He's from, you know, he's born and raised in New York. So when he was at the University of Virginia, we had a softball team, and we had a great softball team. He was on the team. Rick Carlisle was on the team. Ralph Sampson was on the team.
Pretty good.
Bob Bradley was on the team.
It's an all-star team.
Oh, it was really incredible. It was a lot of fun. And Arena would hit the ball. And, you know, he'd run around the bases.
Right.
And, you know, he'd try to act like Reggie Jackson.
He's a New Yorker.
He was an obnoxious New York guy living in quaint, staid, old Charlottesville, you know. And so, as you can imagine, he stood out.
As opposed to the obnoxious, you know, Pennsylvania guy.
Exactly.
They're none of those guys.
Yeah, we became close friends.
Right.
So out of college, you know, I'm fascinated by, you know, the path that people take. Because sometimes people think they choose a path. But actually, a lot of times paths choose them.
Yeah.
You know, so most college kids, when they're getting ready to graduate, there's a little bit of fear. Like, what the hell am I going to do with my degree? Like, where am I going to end up? What was it like going out after school when you got to be on your own, you know, and it's no more going with your dad or no more going anywhere?
I was very lucky. During my senior year, and I had all these clips, and I was the sports editor of the paper, and, you know, I had great summer jobs. You know, I was an intern at the New York Times for two summers. Spent another summer transcribing tapes for my dad for his Bo Jackson book. I was like, you know, in those days, you know, there was no internet, so I kind of like my father would just essentially keep me chained to a desk working for him all summer. You know, anything he needed done, research, I was there because there was no Google. But when I was a senior in college, I got a great job. It was a 1-year job technically working at Sports Illustrated, but it was really a separate unit entirely that was producing content. Well, they didn't use the term content, I guess, about the 92 Olympics, the 92 Winter Olympics and the 92 Summer Olympics. And as an Olympics enthusiast, it was a great job for me. I mean, I was 21 years old, and I had an office in the Time Life building on the 45th or 46th floor, and you know, I was making $30,000 a year, which seemed like $1 million even in New York City in 1991. And you know, I was very fortunate because 1991, that college class coming out that year was kind of still encountering still a recession. Mm-hmm. Newspaper jobs were very hard to come by. I applied for a lot of newspaper jobs, didn't get any of them. But fortunately, one of my dad's old friends, a very talented editor named Steve Gelman, who had worked at Time Life for a long time, was in charge of this Olympic project. And, you know, more on the strength, I think, of my genes than on my clips, hired me to work on this project for a year. And it was great. And so I got to write for these special advertising sections that were in the International Edition of Time. You know, I had some bylines. I wrote for the official. This is a funny story. So the main part of the job, Gino, was putting together the official souvenir program for the Barcelona Olympics. You know, the big glossy souvenir program. Yeah. And it came out. It was a big project, four languages, English and French, which, you know, are the Olympic official languages, plus Spanish and Catalan. I was given the assignment of, among other things, picking three athletes to profile in this thing that would, you know, be sold all over Barcelona, all over the world, on TV. There was no internet again. And so I had to pick three sure things because this thing went to press in, like, May. And, of course, the games were in August. Mm-hmm. So it had to be three sure things. So I picked Gao Min, a Chinese diver, who would end up winning another gold medal in Barcelona, great diver. I picked Felix Savone, the Cuban heavyweight, who would win another gold medal in Barcelona. And then the other sure thing pick, the lock of the century, I picked Dan O'Brien, who, of course, ended up no hiding in the pole vault at the Olympic trials in New Orleans. And so there were hundreds of thousands of these things on the streets of Barcelona and around the world featuring, you know, there were 10,000 athletes at the Olympics, three of them profiled in the official program, and one of them did not qualify for the Olympics. So that's
How about that? That's crazy. That's crazy. Well, you know, when you get a chance to do something like that and you make mistakes, you get the high of getting something right. You get to feel the low.
Yep.
You get to experience all the emotions that go into, you know, when you have to put yourself out there. When you decide to write a book, because two things that have always intrigued me, people that can write music and people that play music, right? Play music and people that can sit down and write a book. And know how it's going to begin, how it's going to end, how I want this to read, and to be able to have the ability to do that. And when you decided to write Cinderella Man, how did you come up with that?
Well, I remember it vividly. I was sitting at like a coffee shop or bar, 6th Avenue, 13th Street in New York with a college friend of mine, Scott Waxman, who's a very successful literary agent. Even then, this is like 14, 15 years ago. For years, I've been saying, look, no, I'm a writer. I had been a freelance writer. I'd written some magazine profiles here and there. And I'd always, you know, had this plan in my mind. I wanted to write a book. My dad wrote 33 books. I'm going to write a book. And I felt I had something to say. But I never had really the idea, a good idea. So Scott said, hey, you know, they're making a movie about Jim Braddock. Nobody's ever written a book really about Jim Braddock, or not in a long time anyway, not since the 1930s. What do you think about writing a book that might coincide with this film that's being made? I said, I love the Jim Braddock story. I love the Max Baer story. You know what? I'm going to do it. Finally going to get off my butt and actually write the book. And I guess I was about 34 at the time, something like that, 33, 34. And I said, you know, I'm going to do it. And I fell in love with the story. And Scott sold the book very quickly to a great editor at Houghton Mifflin, Susan Canavan, who shepherded the project. And, I immersed myself in it. You know, and I look back now, I wrote that book, which did well. And then 18 months later, I published a book about Jesse Owens, Triumph, which did nicely. And I figured, oh, I'm going to do this every year. I'm going to do this every year and a half, like my dad did. And then life changed. You know, I got married. I had three kids.
Yeah.
I used to write those books between midnight and 3 a.m. pretty much. Now, you know, I'm asleep most nights by like 10 p.m. So I feel kind of bad. I haven't followed up on those two. And they were books that gave me, you know, it was a great experience. And I'd like to do more. In fact, right after Triumph came out in 2007, I was having a conversation. It sounds like name dropping, but he was a friend. David Halberstam calls me.
How about that?
And he says, "This is Jeremy, like, what should it be, Dave? He said, you have to write a book about the New York Mets and 1969 season. Nobody's great story. I can't do it. I'm writing a book about the 58 NFL season, the 58 Giants, Colts. I said, okay, you're David Halverson. I'll do it. That's a great idea. And he said, I'm going to, you know, I'll teach you how to do it, because I never really dealt with living people before. My two books were about guys were long gone. And he said, I'll teach you how to do it. I'll show you the ropes. And, one of the a horrible tragedy took place within a week of that conversation. David Halverson died in a car crash.
Yeah.
California.
Yeah.
And I never got, a horrible tragedy, a great man, great journalist.
Couple of great books that he came out with.
Oh my!
Really.
Long story short, I have not gotten around to writing the book about the Met. I'm not sure where to go from here, but I've got some ideas. But it's nice. I still take pride in those things that are on my shelf.
In basketball, accuracy can be the difference between winning and losing, and this is also true when it comes to your health. The Genius 3D Mammography Exam is a more accurate and comfortable mammogram for all women. So why not find the facility that offers the Genius Exam near you? Visit Genius3DNearMe.com to learn more. And make sure your next mammogram is a Genius Exam. Is your retirement game plan a well-executed play or a wild shot at the buzzer? Johnson Brunetti has helped over 2,500 Connecticut families prepare for a financially secure retirement, and they are proud to be the wealth management partner of the UConn Huskies. Visit them at johnsonbrunetti.com and see how they can help you with your retirement. Johnson Brunetti, retirement and investment specialist. Go to johnsonbrunetti.com for free books and financial planning tools. I just discovered something that's pretty extraordinary. I'd heard about it from some coaches and pro athletes, and now I've experienced it for myself. Mizzen & Main, Dallas-based company, is the maker of performance fabric dress shirts. Now you say, what's performance fabric? Well, you know, the stuff you work out in. So you get all the benefits of workout gear, but you wear it with a suit. You can dress it up, dress it down, put a tie on it, don't put a tie on it. So if you see me on the court lately, that's what I'm wearing. You don't know that it's a dress shirt. It feels like a casual shirt, but it looks like a dress shirt. Yet, it moves around you like workout gear. It's revolutionary. You can check out www.mizzenandmain. That's M-I-Z-Z-E-N and Main, M-A-I-N. .com/Gino. See some of my favorite shirts. Take a look. You'll be impressed. Give it a shot. Husky fans, I know there's no one more loyal than you, and I appreciate that. You know what else appreciates loyalty? AAA. So much so that they'll reward you for it, like how you get savings on AAA auto insurance just for being a AAA member. And the longer you're a member, the more you could save. Have both AAA auto and AAA home insurance? You could save even more. Have you been loyal to your existing insurance company for a while? Well, they'll reward that too with a discount when you switch to AAA. But your loyalty gets you more than savings. It gets you comprehensive help from an expert agent who gets to know you, because when your AAA expert agent knows you better, they can help you better. For insurance that's not just insurance, turn to AAA. So what's Max Baer's son? It is his son, right?
It is his son, Max Baer Jr.
Jethro. On the Beverly Hillbillies.
That's right.
A lot of people maybe not don't know that.
Big character, Max Baer.
What's he? Is he still alive?
Max Baer Jr. is still alive. I have not spoken to him in many years.
Yeah.
But he was really a lot of fun.
I'll bet.
And he had great stories. And he told me some of the great stories, you know, about his dad, who was just, he was a remarkably talented fighter, but also a big character, too. And they had, stuff that we can't really get into here, unfortunately, Gino. Max has got interesting stories about the Hollywood scene of the 1950s and 1960s. Pretty much, he he knew everyone. He dated everyone.
Yeah.
Great story. Great character. That's a guy who should write a memoir. Yeah, maybe he has.
There you go. There you go. What stands out for you as kind of a defining moment of your career at ESPN?
Well, there are a few things I would say. I think the extent that anybody knows who I am, the first thing they think of is the interview I did with Bob Knight after he was fired. And that was just, that was an interesting experience. And I think that interview, which became confrontational, kind of put me on the map for a lot of people. You don't get a lot of opportunities in those moments to do those kinds of interviews with the guy that everybody wants in the chair, who's a challenging interview in the best of circumstances, who was fiery that night in a live situation, which is different from most, interviews you see. Mm-hmm. That was a big one. I did a piece a few years after that about Bobby Fischer, which I come back to because it was kind of this again, a bizarre situation, but it ended up being kind of deeply personal. The Fischer story, going to see him in Iceland after he'd been released from prison in Japan. That's a story. It's another situation where you don't get too many stories like that over the course of a lifetime.
Well, it's funny. After that Bobby Knight interview, and anybody who knows Knight knows, for all his great qualities, which he's got a lot, obviously, not the easiest guy in the world to talk to in general, much less, I don't have to tell you. But I remember our SID saying to me, hey, ESPN wants to do this feature on you. I said, oh, really? He goes, yeah, they're going to send somebody out here. I go, oh. I said, who's it going to be? And he said, you're going to be with Jeremy Schapp. And I'm like, damn, why? Can't I talk to his dad instead? I don't want to talk to him. So he's a pain in the ass. You see what happened with that other thing? And I was laughing the whole time, But, people get to see you. And then did you ever, after that, when you had to interview somebody, did they ever almost look at you like, because 60 Minutes did the same thing with me. They go, hey, we want to come out and do a piece. And I go, well, who's it going to be? Mike Wallace? Or because they say, no, it's going to be Morley Safer. I said, I'm in. Did you ever get this feeling from somebody you were going to interview that going, oh, this guy, he doesn't trust me. He doesn't, he's going to make me look bad.
Oh, sure. Okay. Sure. I think, that's the fine line. If you're, I feel like if you go back and look at what I've done over the years, it's always been fair. I don't think I've ever out to, make somebody look bad.
For sure.
I think I've asked questions and I've tried to do it. Fairly. I've tried to give people the opportunity to state their cases, but a lot of people aren't—they're just not interested in that. I remember once. This is kind of something a colleague of mine, Willie Weinbaum, I talk about a lot. Willie was 20 years ago, but trying to get an interview with Albert Bell when he was a free agent, the great baseball player.
Oh God!
And his Albert Bell was tough too, and his brother Terry, who was representing him, and. Terry, who's no longer with us, finally, after a long period of time, Willie telling him, hey, this is going to be a fair story. We're not interested in, being unfair, this. And Terry finally says, you don't get it. I'm not interested in a fair story. I'm interested in a good story. And that's the way it is sometimes. Yeah. And sure, if you're going to have a reputation for asking people tough questions, you're not always going to get people to sit in the chair. That's what happens.
I couldn't agree with you more on that. You're one of your cohorts, Bob Lee. His daughter and my daughter went to high school together. Always been a big fan. What makes him
great
so good?
School.
What makes him so good?
Orders. Bob.
What makes Bob Lee so good?
Bob, so I've been working with Bob for 25 years, And it pains me to say this in public because I try not to inflate his ego. But Bob is, he's so committed to being fair, to being journalistically sound. I've been working with him, as I said, for a quarter century. The guy never mails it in. He's always prepared. He works himself to death. He cares. He cares about the story. He cares about the people. He cares about his colleagues. You know, he's been the conscience of this place for a long, long time. You know, what I like is that in the last couple of years in particular, he's also shown us his funny side, his personality.
Yeah.
And it took a long time for him to decide that it was okay not to be just kind of the dispassionate justice sitting on the bench, the neutral arbiter, and to show us who he really is and to express opinion. And now we've got, I think, Bob's better than ever. He's more effective than ever. And he's a Menchie guy. And as a journalist, he's always prepared. He wants to dig deep. And look, he could have decided a long time ago, you know what I want to do? You know, play by play on this, or I want to do this or that, which are all worthy pursuits. But he has remained committed to journalism when it wasn't always the fashionable thing, when certainly it isn't the thing that draws the most eyeballs. I will say this, and I mean this is the highest kind of compliment in our business. He's more interested in being good than being a star.
Yeah.
And he's both. But I'll tell you what he's doing.
Let me ask you another thing about that part of your job. What is the most memorable E60 or Outside the Lines or any of those features
right.
that you've worked on?
For me, they're kind of related, but one in particular, which I'm proud of, is the story that we did about Qatar and conditions in which migrant laborers there live and work. And that was a story we did.
Is that the one to get ready for the World Cup?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, about building for the World Cup. And it was a story that, was largely unknown. Story that we were working on for years. Story that I think opened up a lot of eyes about the systems in place in Qatar, which is one of the richest countries in the world, which is going to be the host of the world's most popular sports event. And which, you know, continues, I think, to make a difference because there's still pressure being applied to improve the conditions for the workers in Qatar. And that's really the thing that's been most rewarding. 11 years plus that we've been working on E60, that we've kind of carved out this niche doing stories on human rights issues around the world, social justice issues here in the U.S. and around the world, that sometimes are only tangentially about sports, only marginally about sports. But that's been our mandate, tell these stories. And they're stories about sports and society, and that one's the one that stands out. And then connected with the story that we did about FIFA and Sepp Blatter a year later, which kind of led us in that direction. We did an hour on the mess that was FIFA in particular during the Blatter year. And I think that opened up a lot of eyes, too, and the timing was good. It ended up coming out just before investigations were announced into the working with the FIFA, broke some news, and within a couple of weeks, not that there's a causal relationship, but timely, within a couple of weeks of that piece, the guy who it seemed like would be in that job forever was out of that.
Well, it's interesting. People on the outside wouldn't know this, but ESPN may do 15 hours on a particular sport. Let's pick soccer, and promote it, show it, talk about it, make it seem like ESPN and soccer are one. And then join us tonight at 10 when Jeremy Schapp takes all of FIFA apart.
Right.
And they don't understand that these are two separate two separate things. I found that out, you know, like what ESPN Sports does and what you guys do on your end. Sometimes they're two different things, that you have that kind of autonomy and that kind of freedom.
That's right.
To follow your own projects.
And you know, we always have. And we've been fortunate. It is, there are relationships with the leagues, and there are relationships with the global governing bodies, all that stuff. But, you know, they've never prevented us from doing our reporting. I'd say the things that we're, most proud of over the years are challenging the powers that be in.
Mm-hmm.
Challenging national government, challenging, regional allies of the U.S., whatever it may be, we've gone out, we've done those stories, and the human rights stuff that we've done in India, and Qatar, and Bahrain.
And these are all serious, serious topics that end up being, obviously sort of cultural changing. The culture of a lot of sports. And then you do something which I think isn't necessarily culturally seismic. A guy shoots himself in a nightclub in New York. Is that more funny or is that more...
that one, Plexico Burress, it was right around Thanksgiving, 2008.
Yeah.
It's not funny.
No, it's not.
Because... circumstances, there is certainly something comedic about the circumstances of somebody shooting themselves in the leg, grazing themselves,
right.
Essentially a skin wound, and then ending up in prison for 20 months, losing $35 million, yeah. Bringing down the Giants season, all of those things. But for Plexico, very sad. I mean, and look, I believe, he deserves to be punished. He broke the law. He discharged a loaded gun in a crowded nightclub in New York. Then we sat down with him to do that first interview with him about it. But that's an example. It's like you ask him the questions, how did this happen? How do you let this happen? How do you live with yourself after? You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, he is so lucky he didn't kill somebody for himself.
Exactly. Exactly.
So fortunate he didn't kill himself or somebody else. And at the same time, you can appreciate, he paid a heavy price for that mistake.
He did. He did. And you're right. New York, for those people who live there, obviously, has one of the most stringent, severe gun laws in America.
Yeah. It's been a while now, Gina, but I think, if he'd pretty much done that anywhere other than in the city limit, he'd come into the city that night.
Yeah.
Specifically with a gun, if he'd stayed in Jersey that night and done the same thing, different outcome.
Yeah.
Certainly in many parts of the country, different outcome where there's, steel and open carry laws. I mean,
right.
Plexico picked the wrong city in which to discharge. At that point, the gun, I don't think, was legally registered. I don't want to say, I think it had been at one point, but it expired. I don't want to, it's been so long, but. Yeah, the thing is, though, people don't know, if he'd just driven to New Jersey, which if you know where he was, like 49th and Lex, could have been through the Lincoln Tunnel in 10 minutes back in Jersey and gone to a hospital in Hoboken instead of a hospital on 70th and 1st, New York Hospital. But he thought he was dying. He saw blood and thought he was dying. He's like, get me to a hospital. Turned out, I think he told me that, it was basically a Band-Aid. He just gone home.
It's not
home.
Funny. Nope. I mean, I know it's not funny.
Nobody would have known.
Right.
Nobody heard the gunshot. It was so loud in the club. He's the only one who knew it went off.
How about
that? So when you think about a life, like his, turned upside down by that, it's just amazing.
Well, that's a topic for another night that I would love to explore with you, having to do with athletes and incidents off the field of behavior, firearms whatever it is that takes athletes the person watching on Sunday afternoon or Saturday or whatever, and sees these guys play and thinks these guys have world you know, in the palm of their hand. They've got it made. And some of the things that either within their control or without their control that they get involved in that just makes you shake your head and how sad it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so many stories we've done over the years. So many.
What's your next project? I know you got to go. I know you don't have much time. What's your next project?
I'm really excited about this one. So on December 11th, I've been working on with my colleague Ben Hauser, great editor Mike Schaus, great cameraman Mike Block, and his team, documentary 30 for 30 on the Buster Douglas upset against Mike Tyson, February 11th, 1990.
Really?
And nobody's ever told the story before from Buster's perspective. Nobody knows anything about Buster. I think one of the things that's so interesting about the story is that, you know, Buster Douglas is a name that, you know, I think certainly people over the age of 30, they know the name.
Right.
And they can tell you the first sentence, you know, of his biography, guy who knocked out Mike Tyson. But they know nothing else about him. No second sentence, no second clause, you know. And he's got an amazing story. And it's always fascinating me, Gino, how someone at a particular moment, and you see this in basketball, you see this in all sports, finds the best version of themselves at a moment when it matters most.
Yeah.
And they might never get there again. They might never have gotten there before. Certainly Buster Douglas's case, you know, you say what you want about his career afterwards, his career beforehand. He was a guy with talent. He didn't always marshal. He wasn't always motivated, certainly. But for one morning in Tokyo, early afternoon, nighttime back here in the U.S., he was a champion. And he didn't get lucky. He didn't win with a lucky punch. It was a 10-round fight, and he kicked the stuffing out of Mike Tyson for most of those 10 rounds. And I've always been fascinated by the Buster story, so I'm really excited that we're doing it for 30-30.
Well, you know, and I know I got to let you go. Coaches ask me all the time, you know, about success, you know, and I have a kind of a standard reply that I find to be really, really true. And you just touched on it. You know, if you're lucky in life and you're fortunate in life, at some point, if you're very fortunate, fate will tap you on the shoulder and say, this is your time right now. And if you're prepared and you have prepared yourself and you take advantage of it, something magical happens. And it may never happen again. And it may never happen once in your life. But the worst thing in the world is for fate to tap you and say, this is your time, and you're not prepared, and it passes you by.
Right.
And that happens to a lot of really, really talented coaches, writers, athletes. It doesn't matter. They get their moment, here it comes, and they're not prepared, and it just doesn't happen for them. And I think your case, you know, growing up and the way you did and aspiring to be what you aspired to be, and like you said, fate tapped you on the shoulder because of whatever circumstances, and then you did the rest and carved out an amazing career for yourself and your family. And it's a pleasure listening to you. It's a pleasure watching some of the things that you've put together. And
I'm very excited.
Probably the best thing that anyone could ever say about a sports writer, a journalist in your case, is that they are fair. You might not like what they say. You might not like the questions, but they're fair, and you're fair to the people that, and I know this from personal history, you're fair. And I think every coach, every athlete, you name it, appreciates that. And I certainly appreciate you taking the time to spend with us, Jeremy.
It's been an honor, Gino. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk again, all right?
I would love that.
Okay. Take care, my friend.
Thank you, Gino. That was
all right.
Great.
Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, everyone. Really, really interesting guy, don't you think? Jeremy Schapp. We could have gone for 2 hours. Unfortunately, Jeremy had to run to another event that he's got going. In a short time, managed to touch on a lot of topics. If you're interested in some of the things that he talked about, if you saw the movie, The Cinderella Man, on James Braddock, I would encourage you to get that book, his book on Jesse Owens and the Olympics during the time in Germany that Adolf Hitler was taking that country down a dark road. Walt Disney is in the process of turning that into a feature film. As I said, we could have talked about a lot of things over a long period of time, but I found it really fascinating. So thank you for joining us. Look for our next podcast, Holding Court with Gino Auriemma. This is Gino Auriemma saying, talk to you soon.